Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. Coming up, a bomb blasts through a commuter train in southern Russia near the Chechen border with all the hallmarks of a Chechen rebel strike, including female suicide bombers.
The Russian press calls them black widows. Some of them are widows whose husbands died during the war. Some of them are not, and it's hard to sort of fathom what motivation they have.
Also, the Fujian A strain of flu hits hard in Colorado and other states. And we visit a program in Rhode Island for children who have a dangerous obsession with fire.
The side of my sink is kind of singed. It just seemed like a fascination that he was compelled to do it, even though he knew that it wasn't a safe thing to be doing.
These stories and the new Tom Cruise film, The Last Samurai, coming up Here and Now. News is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The nation's unemployment rate dropped below 6% last month. The Labor Department says the jobless rate dipped to 5.9%. The U.S. economy added 57,000 new jobs in November. Many analysts had expected about 150,000 new jobs, but economist Hugh Johnson at First Albany says he is encouraged.
At first blush, the numbers don't look good. 57,000 jobs, well below the consensus expectation. But if you take into consideration the fact there were so many striking workers in California, the number's not quite so bad. So I think on balance, you look at these numbers, the unemployment rate and the growth in jobs, and you have to say it was a pretty good month.
The U.S. economy has added more than 300,000 jobs during the past 4 months. President Bush has named former Secretary of State James Baker as a special envoy to Iraq to deal with that country's debt. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Baker's job will be to find ways for Iraq to get out from under the burden of a debt that's been estimated to be between $120 and $200 billion. The White House is concerned that without some relief, fixing the Iraqi economy will be even more difficult. That Baker would be the president's choice to handle the job is not exactly a surprise. He's a longtime friend and confidant of the Bush family, having been Secretary of State under the first President Bush, and both Chief of Staff and Treasury Secretary to Ronald Reagan prior to that. James Baker also has a history with George W. Bush. In the weeks following the November 2000 election, he was brought in to coordinate the Bush campaign's legal strategy during the controversial Florida vote recount. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
A bomb exploded today on a busy road in central Baghdad. A U.S. soldier and at least two Iraqis were killed in the blast, and 16 others were hurt. Police and witnesses say the bomb went off as a military convoy and a packed minibus passed in opposite directions. It came the day before Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is due to visit Baghdad. The top American official in Iraq predicts an increase in attacks against U.S. and allied targets over the next few months. Paul Bremer told the Associated Press insurgents are threatened by the progress being made in Iraq.
Now we're getting ready to spend billions of dollars here on building out the electricity, on building out the hospitals, on fixing the railroads. And the dead-enders can see that this momentum is, plus the fact that the Iraqi people are going to get their sovereignty back, this spells trouble for them. And so I think we will actually go through a phase now where we'll see increased attacks.
November was the deadliest month for U.S.-led forces since the invasion of Iraq on March 20th. More than 100 U.S. and allied troops were killed. Stocks are lower at this hour. The Dow Industrials are down 49 points. The Nasdaq is down about 20. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, the United Nations International Maritime Organization has voted to accelerate the planned phase-out of single-hull oil tankers. The IMO has agreed to ban most such vessels by 2010, with the oldest ones to be phased out by April 2005. The European Union has been calling for accelerating the ban since an oil spill from an aging tanker fouled the beaches of northwestern Spain. The internet search firm Google is seeking a legal ruling on trademarked words used in searches. At issue is how far companies can go in claiming ownership of words and phrases used as keywords. Jason Lopez has the story from San Francisco.
Companies want their names to come up when their trademarked phrases are used as search keywords on Google. They don't want competitors' names to appear. Reuters reports that some Google advertisers have complained, claiming their trademarks bring up Internet links of competitors. But some firms are pushing beyond that, demanding that Google refrain from using variations or fragments of trademarked phrases. It's unclear whether these are protected by the law. Google wants to clear up the issue before staging a much-anticipated initial public offering expected sometime next year. The company has asked a federal judge to rule on the matter in order to set the record straight. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
Discount retailer Kmart says it lost only $23 million during the third quarter. That compares to $383 million during the same quarter last year. The loss amounts to about 26 cents a share. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, providing research and information on health issues to policymakers and the general public at kff.org.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is off today. It's Here and Now. The bomb blast that blew passengers out of their morning train near the Russian city of Yessentuki, killing at least 36 and wounding hundreds, has all the hallmarks of a suicide strike by Chechen rebels. But rebel leaders have denied involvement in the attack. Russia's interior minister has vowed whoever did it will be found and the earth will be burning under their feet. Joining us from Moscow is Peter Baker, correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the call.
Well, we know that this blast was some 750 miles south of you. I assume, though, that you're watching a lot about it on television. Can you tell us about some of the details that are being shared and how Russians are reacting?
Well, it's a pretty horrific scene. The televised pictures coming from the site of the bombing show a pretty demolished train car. A lot of wounded people, a lot of bodies were found there. The latest death toll is around 40. At least another 150, 160 people were wounded. So it's a pretty grisly scene, and Russians have seen this increasingly over the last year and are very, very traumatized by this sort of wave of terrorism that doesn't seem to go away.
Why this target, do we know?
This is actually a train line, a commuter train line in southern Russia near Chechnya that actually was hit 3 months ago. It was the very same train line by a bomb that killed six or seven people back then. So clearly whoever did it back then, you know, found it an opportune target and apparently was not caught. And if it's the same people, obviously they decided to go back to what worked before.
Yeah. Well, you said it's nearby the Chechen Republic. It's not inside. The rebel Chechen movement has denied responsibility for the blast. Do they traditionally claim responsibility when they make an attack?
They often deny it. The leadership of the Chechen movement often denies responsibility for these types of attacks, and the Russians knee-jerk automatically assign blame to them for it. So, you know, the truth is always hard to kind of muddle through, but it's hard to, it's important to remember that the Chechen movement is fragmented into clans and different factions and sections and so forth. So even if one Chechen leader or commander says he had nothing to do with it, doesn't mean that his allies didn't, or maybe even his, you know, some of the Arab compatriots who've been fighting down there.
What has Russian President Vladimir Putin said about this, and how does this, as tragic as this incident is, how does it play politically?
Well, Putin today said that this was an attempt to destabilize the country just 2 days before parliamentary elections. All of Russia goes to the polls on Sunday to elect a new state Duma. It's an election they have only once every 4 years, so it's a very fraught with politics. He may benefit from this on some level because, you know, he came to power as a tough guy, as somebody who was going to combat terrorists, and that's been a strength of his. But on the other hand, it's also a reminder that the war he started in 1999 still hasn't ended and still hasn't gone away.
I want to go back to one detail from the blast itself. There were four attackers who were seen. Three of them were women. two women left from the train before the blast. A man was found dead with grenades still strapped to his legs. That's not unusual that a woman would be involved in a bomb blast in Russia.
Increasingly, it's very common. About a dozen suicide bombings over the last year, many of them have been women suicide bombers. The Russian press calls them black widows. Some of them are widows, Chechens, whose husbands died during the war. Some of them are not, and it's hard to sort of fathom what motivation they have. But it's increasingly common here in Russia.
Well, Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Baker, correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke to us from Moscow. U.S. researchers say 82% of this year's flu cases are from a strain called the Fujian A. And the Fujian A-fueled flu season began early and is hitting hard. Colorado has seen over 6,000 cases so far. At least 5 children are dead. And flu season is still a month from reaching its usual peak. Dr. Jerome Klein is a professor of pediatrics at Boston Medical Center and an expert on infectious diseases. He joins us on the line. Hello, doctor.
Hello, Robin.
Well, a lot of people get vaccinated for the flu, and now they're wondering, was I vaccinated against the Fujian A strain?
The Fujian A strain is closely related to the strain that is in the vaccine. It's not precise, but it's close enough so that there still will be substantial protection from the current vaccine.
Well, and how does the CDC decide what strain of a flu to vaccinate against?
Sometime in the prior spring, the experts from the CDC, the NIH, the manufacturers get together. They have information usually coming from the Far East about what the likely strains are, what is prevalent in those locations at that time. And they make a bet that the strains will be those that will be traveling across the Pacific to the United States in the fall. So it's a calculated guess, and most of the time they're right.
Did they bet wrong this time, do you think?
No, I would say it's not wrong because the virus is constantly changing and mutating, and this one is a slight mutation that is closely allied to the one in the vaccine, but not precisely the same.
Well, some of the children that died, we know, were vaccinated. Is the CDC going to come out with another vaccination that is just for the Fujian A?
I don't think that'll be possible, Robin. It takes about 6 months to go through the manufacturing process. That's why they have to make their bet in March, so they have vaccine available in the fall. Mm-hmm. So it will not be possible to gear up to have another vaccine. But we should mention about children that for the first time that they get the influenza vaccine, they require 2 doses about a month apart, so that if there are some listeners who have infants and young children who have not yet received the vaccine, they should do so as quickly as possible because there will be need for another dose in about a month.
And I was going to ask, how about everybody else? If this flu has pretty much hit the country, is it too late to vaccinate against it?
No, because we don't know the dynamic yet. It's possible that it will diminish and that we'll really get the big hit in January or February. It's already hitting in some of the Midwestern states, Colorado, as you mentioned, Oklahoma. But for any of the listeners nationally, flu will probably be traveling to their locale, and it's no time like the present to get the vaccine.
Well, doctor, thank you.
Surely.
Dr. Jerome Klein is a professor of pediatrics at Boston Medical Center. At 8:30 this morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released November's unemployment figures. 0.1% was shaved off October's figure, and now at 5.9%, the rate is the lowest it's been in 8 months. Cindy Perman is an editor for The Wall Street Journal Online. She joins me from New York. Cindy, what's the reaction been to these numbers released today?
Well, the initial knee-jerk, I think, from economists was, oh my goodness, you know, payrolls didn't grow by as much as they had thought. People were expecting 150,000 jobs to be added this last month, and you know, it was less than two-thirds, really. It was about 57,000 that were actually added. So that was a knee-jerk. But I think once people dug into the data, they realized there were some encouraging things in there and that that this doesn't mean that the recovery is off or there's no hope for the unemployed person.
How many jobs did seem to be added in this recent report?
Well, in the recent report, it was 57,000. Generally, you're seeing people say about 150,000 mm-hmm. is what needs to happen over the next 3 to 6 months in order to really believe that the labor market is on the road to recovery.
Well, tell us about some of the other bright spots. And I'm also noting that you wrote that the average work week expanded, which means people are making things, which does that mean people will hire people to make things?
That's exactly what that means. That was one of the underlying things that economists really took some encouragement with. You know, if we're seeing a huge increase in production, and they're boosting the work week, which means there is demand out there. And if that continues, then they're going to have no choice. And manufacturers in particular, they're going to have no choice but to start hiring people.
Well, let's just ask about that because, you know, there are some people who fear they do have a choice. They can make people work longer, harder hours and keep less people on a payroll with benefits.
That just can't be sustained, though. As we're seeing the pickup in demand, economists are mm-hmm. largely saying that they are really going to have to start hiring.
Mm. What about the invisible unemployed that we hear about, people who have just given up looking for jobs, they've dropped off the unemployment rolls, or maybe they're partially employed but still not making ends meet? How is that community doing?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the Labor Department is smart about the way they calculate these things. They understand that there are people that have given up or people for one reason or another, maybe they're in school or they have family reasons why they might not be looking. So basically what they said in this report is there were 1.5 million of those people. That means those people wanted jobs, they were available for jobs, but for whatever reason, when this report was calculated, within the last 4 weeks before that survey, they weren't looking. And really only about a third of those people were counted as discouraged workers, which means they're just not looking at all. So I think that overall, you know, it's not necessarily a bad sign, and those people are counted.
Mm. And what do we look forward to with the numbers that have come out today, and we're heading into a holiday season? What's your expectation?
One of the things certainly that weighed down the November report were the grocery store strikes in California and other states, and hopefully going forward we won't have that effect. Which would alleviate some of the pressure and mean that employers could boost payrolls more. And also there's the effect of seasonal hiring this month. Now, the Labor Department does account for that, but I think that will also help boost payrolls.
Cindy, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Cindy Perman, editor for The Wall Street Journal Online. And this news to report, President Bush is calling on longtime family troubleshooter, former Secretary of State James Baker, to oversee the job of getting Iraq out from under its $125 billion debt. As the president's personal envoy on the issue, Baker will tackle a major problem in the rebuilding of Iraq. Iraq's debt now carries annual servicing charges of $7 to $8 billion. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan says Baker's experience in diplomacy and world finance will help forge an international consensus for equitable and effective resolution on the issue. And just ahead, we talk to parents, their children, and doctors about kids who are obsessed with fire. And later in the program, a look at Tom Cruise's epic new movie, The Last Samurai. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Every year, more kids are arrested for arson than adults. Fires set by minors cause 300 deaths, 4,000 injuries, and $600 million worth of damage annually. 62% of child fire setters are just curious. 38% are seriously troubled. But all can benefit from intervention, and Rhode Island is intervening. Bradley Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, co-sponsors a program called Fire Safe Families, where parents and their children, counselors and firefighters work on the urges kids have to play with fire.
Regarding your granddaughter and her fire-setting incident, we wanted to bring her back to the time where she actually had had that incident and remember what her thoughts, feelings, and body responses were for that particular incident.
Recently, I spent a Saturday morning visiting one of the four-week counseling sessions, speaking to families who asked that their names be kept confidential, but their stories told.
So, Grandpa, tell me, when did the family first know that maybe there was some use for this program here?
When our granddaughter started playing with the stove, matches, we would say to her, "Why are you playing with the stove, or why are you playing with matches?" She would say, "I don't know."
Let's ask you now. Why were you playing with the stove? Can you now that you've been in the program for a little while, can you figure out why?
Because I was bored. I didn't have anything else to do.
Can you try to explain the feeling of how it felt?
It felt fun.
Well, the stove is one thing. Did you ever play with matches as well? Because as you know, a lot of kids do that.
Yeah, I play with matches, but I just don't know how to light a lighter.
Thankfully. Where would you play with the matches?
The library field.
A field up near your house?
Yeah, it's down the street from my house.
What happened when you lit the match? Did anything catch on fire?
My cousin, she went home to get some cologne, because when I lit the match and threw it in, she went home to get some cologne, and she put it on it, and the flames grown big, and then all the fire station went down to the library.
What were you thinking when the fire started to get big?
That it might catch on to something.
Now, what did that feel like?
Scared. Not so fun.
Dr. Stephen Barreto and Dr. Margaret Passioni are two of the many counselors working with the children.
Very young children, fire literally dances before their eyes. It's very, very beautiful, exciting. And it bounces back and forth. It has, vibrant colors. And then as kids get a little bit older, 7, 8, and 9, it's a sense of power and control as they watch the fire, a sense of competency. I can be grown up and do the things that grown-ups do.
Yeah, a key piece is that everybody gets excited about fire, and this is okay. Now what are we going to do with that? Let's learn some ways to channel that. And then along with that, if you have a set of emotions, that are disturbing to you, you don't need to turn to the fireplace. There are other things that you can do to feel better.
We met a mother at Bradley Hospital whose son had severe compulsions to light fires.
When he and I were with his therapist, he had told both of us that it was a kind of an exciting feeling, but then it was also very scary. I think the scariest time for him was one time when he lit a fire in his bedroom, and he had a bowl of water, and then he couldn't put it out. And that was the scariest time for me because he started screaming for me. I was downstairs, and I came up, and he had gotten it out by the time I was there, but he was obviously just so scared, but he still felt, you know, still something compelling for him. And I think what worried me most was I have a daughter, and I switched her bedroom to the room that's easiest to get out of so that she would be safe.
So now you come to the Bradley Fire Safe Families Program here at the hospital. What did it do for you?
There have been no fires in my house since he started that program. He's still very interested in fire. He asks questions about fires.
What would he ask?
Well, when it's somebody's birthday, he always wants to help light the candles. And there's the zoo in Providence every year has a big jack-o'-lantern thing where they light thousands of jack-o'-lanterns. And we volunteered to help light the jack-o'-lanterns. It wasn't really lighting fires. It was more satisfying the fascination with the fire, but not doing anything that was going to hurt anything.
There are some children who need further serious psychological help, but for most child fire starters, the Fire Safe Families program works because of two principles: talking about a problem considered shameful and secretive, and then acquiring tools or tricks to control it.
Can you tell us a little more about what the things you've learned to do if there's peer pressure, like your cousin or, you know, other kids, or if you just feel bored again, like what will you do?
Think of my fire alarming thought. It's like a thought that you think of before you act.
What happens? Does it, like, a fire alarm goes off in your head or something?
Actually, you just think of one word. Like, my fire alarm thought is punished. Because when I first started to play at matches, I got punished.
So the word comes up and helps you. And then what do you do with those feelings?
I just go play with my friends or running around.
Run around, try to get rid of the feelings, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Grandpa, this is amazing, isn't it?
Sure is amazing. This is the best thing ever happened to the family. Someone really could have got hurt if she played with the fire, like in the morning when everyone's sleeping. The fire could have started. And someone could really got hurt from it.
For more information on the Bradley Hospital Fire Safe Families Program, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, our editorial roundtable convenes, how are papers covering domestic stories from the abduction of a North Dakota college student to the police beating death of a man on drugs in Cincinnati? And we review the new Tom Cruise epic, The Last Samurai.
You believe a man can change his destiny?
I think a man does what he can until his destiny is revealed.
These stories and what is the miso in miso soup? Coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. In what's seen as a move that could pave the way for an eventual trial of Saddam Hussein, Iraq's U.S.-appointed government is establishing a war crimes tribunal. One council member says it would be similar to one proposed in Washington last spring, which called for Iraqi lawyers to present cases to Iraqi judges. That's of concern to human rights groups because it differs from United Nations-sponsored tribunals in which international lawyers and justices are involved. Another U.S. soldier has been killed in Iraq after a bomb blew up near a mosque in Baghdad. Meanwhile, the top U.S. official in Iraq says the situation might get worse before it gets better. Chief Civilian Administrator Paul Bremer says he thinks the attacks on coalition forces will increase during the next few months as the physical and political reconstruction of the country moves ahead.
Now we're getting ready to spend billions of dollars here on building out the electricity, on building out the hospitals, on fixing the railroads, and the dead-enders can see that this momentum is, plus the fact that the Iraqi people are going to get their sovereignty back, this spells trouble for them.
Also today, President Bush has tapped former Secretary of State James Baker to help retire the Iraqi national debt. Baker plans to meet with world leaders in an effort to erase the debt, estimated at $120 billion. Russian officials now believe that four individuals were involved in the suicide attack that killed 36 people on a commuter train in Chechnya. The explosion occurred this morning as the train was approaching a station. Authorities say the explosives were strapped to the body of a man who was helped by three women. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he believes the attack is intended to disrupt this weekend's parliamentary elections. A winter storm is moving up along the eastern seaboard, closing schools and making driving treacherous along the way. Up to 8 inches of snow fell in Maryland and Virginia, and more than a foot is predicted in some areas in the storm's path. Winter storm watches and warnings are posted northward to Maine and New Hampshire. The nation's job market is not improving as quickly as expected, that reaction from an economist, following today's report that only about 57,000 jobs were created last month. Analysts had expected that number to be nearly three times as high. Still, the jobless rate slipped to an 8-month low of 5.9%. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 46 points. The Nasdaq is down 20 points. The S&P 500 is down 4 points.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ohio shootings create climate of fear. Convicted rapist arrested in disappearance of North Dakota college student. Cincinnati man dies in skirmish with police. Baltimore prosecutor found murdered in Pennsylvania field.
These are some of the headlines that have called out from the country's newspapers this week. So we've convened our weekly editorial roundtable to talk about them. Nolan Finley is editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Hi, Nolan.
Hello, Robin.
And Alicia Blaisdell Bannon, managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Robin.
Well, Nolan, let's start with you. The disappearance in North Dakota of a 22-year-old college student has just rocked North Dakota, but people are paying attention to this. There are so many disappearances. Why do you think this story has captured people?
Well, I think the randomness of it. She apparently was just plucked off the street. That's always a little more chilling to people than if it's someone is taken by someone they know or involved in some sort of domestic incident. Plus, I mean, it's North Dakota. You don't expect people to go missing from North Dakota. It's like, you know, if an alligator eats you in the Everglades, it's sort of a big story. But if it eats you on the streets of New York City, it's a really big story. So.
And Alicia, not only that, she was on the phone with her boyfriend in the middle of a sentence when she cried out. And so there's this dramatic sound that's being played. And they've got this convicted rapist who was recently released from prison who was at the scene where she was nabbed.
Yeah, I think that we're all interested in stories that we feel could happen to us. I was struck the other day by, in our paper, we had a pretty sizable package on an Inside Wire page for this story. And in a little brief to the side, we have a little item that says, China, Taiwan vote on split, a cause for war. And I thought, gee, are we, you know, maybe the possibility of war between the Chinas should have been our centerpiece. But I think we are really struck by stories that we feel could happen in our neighborhood or our town.
Yeah, I absolutely think you're right. The ones that could happen and maybe have happened. You know, we have missing Molly Bish right here in Massachusetts, so it resonates with everybody.
Well, and the idea of convicted sex offenders, I think, also is ringing loud with people across the country, too. Mm-hmm. It isn't on Cape Cod, at least.
Well, that's stoking a lot of calls to talk shows where you are,
yeah.
Nolan.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, whenever you have a sexual predator, a sexual offender committing a repeat offense, there's a condemnation of the justice and the correction systems.
Right. Well, let's stay in the Dakotas, but turn south. Congressman Bill Janklow is being tried for running a stop sign at breakneck speed. He killed a passing motorcyclist. He got a boost on the stand. Senator Tom Daschle took the stand in his defense. They're using a diabetic defense. Alicia, your thoughts?
Gee, I don't know. I'm one of these people that thinks every once in a while it would be nice for somebody to just stand up and say, I did this. I was responsible for this. I mean, I appreciate the fact that he has diabetes, but if he has diabetes and the defense is, and he didn't eat, then eat is my simple solution.
Plus, I've talked to diabetics who are not quite sure that's quite how it works. It has to do with your insulin injection, so we might be learning more about diabetes during the course of this trial.
Well, that probably wouldn't be a bad thing
right,
at all.
Right. Nolan?
Well, given this man's driving history, I don't know if that's a very effective defense. I think it's cowardly and dishonorable. And he made a mistake. He made a very tragic and terrible mistake. Was it intentional? No. Was he breaking the law? Yes.
Well, let's turn to the story now in Columbus, Ohio. This is the series of shootings along a stretch of Interstate 270. One person has died. An elementary school was hit. I thought it was interesting, Alicia, that I heard the law enforcement officials say they weren't calling it a sniper, but a shooter, because a sniper indicated a military background.
Oh, that's interesting.
Kind of odd.
Yeah, I think that is odd.
What are you calling it?
We're calling it a sniper. Or we're calling it shootings, but I'm sure that we have used the word sniper. I think most people think of a sniper as someone who stands at a distance and shoots randomly at people or attacks an individual from a distance.
Nolan, has your paper been at all tying this to the sniper shootings in the Maryland area with the ongoing trial there?
Well, there's a mention. You never know if this is a copycat thing or not. But, you know, given that we're so close to Ohio and that during the holidays a good number of our people will be traveling through Ohio, it's a talk story here. You know, people are going to be on the road soon for Christmas, and you don't want to be shot while you're driving. Or
yeah,
no.
This is another one of those that
obviously.
We think it could happen to us kinds
right.
of tales. We had a couple of years ago the same thing on Route 3. Which is one of the main highways that connects us to Boston.
We know about
it. Same thing, that sort of random, it turned out to be, it was kids, or a young man at any rate, shooting in the woods. No one was killed, but it is terrifying as you're planning to drive on that road.
Yeah, and Nolan, you especially right there in Detroit, as you said, so close to Ohio. Let's talk about the Cincinnati incident. 41-year-old Nathaniel Jones died after his skirmish with police. There was video, everybody's probably seen it, of the police pummeling him, but him also taking swings at them. The coroner has ruled that the incident was a homicide. It didn't seem that this story got people going as much as past incidents with police. Nolan, what happened in your area? What was the reaction?
Well, it's been all over the television, obviously. And, you know, I think the difference this time is there's you can see very clearly that he was getting the better of the cops for a while. And I'm not so sure that there's the outrage. People put themselves in that position and wonder what they would do if they were being pummeled by a 350-pound man. And so, the tragedy of all this, though, is the effect on Cincinnati. That's a city that has a wonderful downtown and was doing quite well, and since the racial riots of a couple of years ago, has really seen their downtown starting to fall apart like some other cities as people, you know, pull out in fear, and as this ill-conceived boycott against the city by many groups continues.
And they're boycotting because of, as you said, of the riots.
The tensions, yeah.
And the tensions of a couple of years ago. But as you say, it seems as if this tape tells a different story.
It would seem. I mean, mm-hmm. You just never know. I think the best thing to do always is to let things cool down and do an investigation,
right.
But that never happens.
Well, Alicia, I'm going to ask you to comment on the other story we want to just mention in passing, the Baltimore prosecutor who was trying two rap artists on heroin charges and was found brutally murdered in a field in Pennsylvania.
That's right, and he too got a phone call, I guess, in the middle of the night and left the house and then was stabbed repeatedly. That's one you could juxtapose against the woman in North Dakota who got the phone call, too. It has been interesting to see how that story is being played in papers. That's an awful tragedy. He was a young man on a brilliant career, or on a high career path, and then suddenly ending up like this.
And an African-American, somebody who was, as you said, a rising star in the system.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, it's a story we'll be following as we'll try to follow all of them. It does seem, though, just seems as if there's been sort of a percolation of stories around the country.
Yeah, it seems to be a series of sort of scary stories, and as I say, stories that we feel like could happen to us and are happening in our neighborhoods. So it's an unfortunate time of the year for all that to be happening.
Well, we'll keep an eye on all of it. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Alicia Blaisdell Bannon, managing editor of the Cape Cod Times of Hyannis, Massachusetts, members of our weekly editorial roundtable. Still to come, The Last Samurai. Tom Cruise is transported to 19th century Japan in the new epic film. And you're listening to Here and Now. Did you know that this is Buy Union Week? Much appreciated by those who want to avoid the sweatshop industry and support unions. You can, of course, look for the union label, but now you can also go online at the first virtual online mall that's all union-made products. It's called NoSweatshop.com, and founder Adam Neiman joins us in the studio. Adam, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Robin.
Well, we have gone online, and it doesn't seem as if there's much on the racks quite yet at NoSweatshop.com.
Well, Robin, we've put together, I think, a pretty decent collection. We've got scarves, we've got yoga pants, we've got jeans, we've got all kinds of denim, we've got Oxfords, we've got hoodies and sweats, and what we really wanted to focus on here this first year were things that people would feel comfortable buying sight unseen without trying them on, so things that were easy to fit.
How did you come to this? How did this come to be?
Well, you know, my wife and I have asked ourselves that question on a number of dark nights. We're lapsed activists, and we've always wanted to combine our political passions with what we'll always have to do, which is make a living. And when we conceived this, this brainchild, well, we took a deep breath, said our prayers, refinanced our house, and dived in.
Really? What do you do for a real living?
Oh, I'm in the roofing business. My experience before this was with disorganized labor, which was part of how I came around to thinking about this issue.
Going back to some of the product that's on right now, the online mall, there aren't things, for instance, I'm thinking of higher-end clothing like, you know, cashmere sweaters or leather shoes or... Is it going to broaden out to
those absolutely. Things? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we've located good shops in the United States, in Canada, in South Africa. But, well, L.L. Bean did not begin with a catalog that was 70 pages. You start at a certain point. You see if there's a market there. We've got a lot of interested investors.
You're also backed by Musicians Against Sweatshops, a group that includes Billy Bragg, Chrissy Hynde, the Pretenders. Why is it so important for you to shop union? You know, because there are a lot of young people who don't know what you're talking about when you say that. Do you ever get that?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that we brought the musicians into this. We think the musicians are the best people to make this case. Would a musician work for a record company without a signed contract? Of course not. Why should a worker not have the same rights and obligations spelled out? It's business. It's not a handshake deal. It should be a contract. Hmm.
How do you do your shopping when you're not shopping in your new online mall? Do you look at labels? How do you shop?
I look at labels. I know a lot more about the business now than I did when I first started into it. But it's almost impossible for consumers to identify union product in a store anymore. Most major retailers do not allow a union label on the label.
You mean you can't look for the union label anymore?
Not at major retailers, no.
Huh. Now you can look for the union label online.
That's correct.
Adam Neiman, thank you so much.
All right.
Adam Neiman is the founder of No Sweat Apparel and its online mall, nosweatshop.com. For a link to the Union Mall, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One of the most anticipated holiday movies this year is The Last Samurai, the latest offering from Edward Zwick, who also directed the Civil War epic Glory. Samurai is set shortly after the Civil War. Tom Cruise stars as Nathan Algren, a down-on-his-luck soldier who's hired to teach the Japanese Emperor's army, men used to fighting with spears and swords, to use guns. But in Algren's first battle, he's captured by a rebellious samurai warrior, Katsumoto, played by Ken Watanabe.
This is my son's village. We are deep in the mountains and the winter is coming. You cannot escape.
And the plot unfolds from there. Joining us in the studio is Here Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And what happens next?
Well, Tom Cruise, Nathan Algren, is captured by these samurai led by Katsumoto, who are essentially conducting a rebellion against the emperor. They're upset about the pace of westernization and modernization in Japan. Algren is kept alive so that Katsumoto can practice his English and learn his enemy.
I've seen what you do to your enemies.
Many of our customs seem strange to you, and the same is true of yours. For example, not to introduce yourself is considered extremely rude, even among enemies.
Nathan Algren.
I'm honored to meet.
I have enjoyed this conversation in English.
I have questions.
I have introduced myself. You have introduced yourself. This is a very good conversation.
Over time, Algren develops a tremendous respect for the samurai, for their way of life, and he begins to convert to their way of life, sort of like Stockholm Syndrome 1870s style.
Sort of like Shogun.
sort of like it, yeah.
And does he also fall for a native?
Yes, he does. He falls for the wife of one of the men he killed in this initial battle.
And then, wait, does he also suffer sort of torn loyalties as he's then confronted with his home army, perhaps, something like that?
You know, in this film, not so much.
Okay.
It's not so much the case. But as you're indicating here, this is sort of a standard plot in a lot of ways. We've seen these East meets West movies before, going back as far as, John Wayne's film The Barbarian and the Geisha back in the 1950s. So it's not an unfamiliar territory that we're on here.
But how does it fare?
It doesn't fare too bad. This is a movie that's tremendously ambitious. It's beautifully shot, very lavishly produced, but it does have its share of problems. It's overlong. There's a lot of clunky exposition. We're told within the first hour, no less than 5 or 6 times, that the year is 1876. And it's just not necessary.
Mm-hmm. But how is Tom Cruise?
Cruise isn't bad. You know, Cruise is good. He's very earnest in this role, but I think that some of the problem was the casting. The film really deserves somebody who perhaps has a few more years on him, maybe a little bit more maturity and gravity than Cruise can really bring to the role. But you do have some outstanding supporting performances. Ken Watanabe, who plays Katsumoto, the main samurai character, is just wonderful. He has great screen presence. And Masato Harada, who plays another one of the villains, Umura, who is a railroad baron behind some of these plans to wipe out the samurai, also has a great screen presence as well.
As you said, Ken Watanabe carries a lot of the film. Let's hear a little of him.
The emperor could not hear my words. His army will come. It is the end. For 900 years, my ancestors have protected our people. Now, I have failed them. The way of the samurai is not necessary anymore.
Zwick does do, I think, a pretty nice job of showing a group of people who are struggling to hold on to a way of life that's very dear to them in the face of modernization. And, you know, we see that occurring today just as well.
Hmm. So, Eric, The Last Samurai, worth your, gosh, however much money it is now to buy a ticket to a movie theater?
It's a good movie. It's a game effort. It's not a great film. I'd still say if you really want to see a historical film that works on almost every level, Master and Commander may be your ticket.
Okay, Eric, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Here now is film reviewer Eric Shaver with his thoughts on The Last Samurai, which opens today. Miso soup. You can picture it. Salty, brown, often with small chunks of tofu. But what is miso? And how is it used in cuisine? On a recent trip to Japan, Here and Now food guru Scott Haas went on a miso tour. His guide, Elizabeth Ando, Gourmet Magazine's Japan correspondent.
Most miso is made out of soybeans, and it is an all-purpose seasoning. It's part of the traditional Japanese kitchen. It would be very hard to live in Japan, eat in Japan, without consuming miso in some form or another every day.
I think it's fair to say that most North Americans think of miso as a soup.
Right.
But in Japan,
not only soup, it's used for sauces, used even in confectionery. There are some of the sweeter ones that are used for that. And also as a hidden ingredient, as a seasoning in lieu of salt or sugar or other things. And just as you could talk about wine and there might be hundreds of flavor combinations possible from the same grape, so with miso, even though basically you've got the same ingredients, which are dried soybeans known as daisu, very often enriched with rice, very often enriched with other grains like barley, the enormous range of flavor and texture is what miso is all about.
So let's let me take you have a list of misos that I can look at?
We've got the four basic ones that I would say form a basic wardrobe. You've got a very light, sweet one that's known in Kyoto as Saikyo Shiromiso, and that it's almost creamy, caramel-like in flavor.
Well, looking at this list here, why don't we try this fourth one here? It says brown rice-enriched fermented bean paste.
Okay.
That sounds interesting. I mean, I don't really know. I'm not an expert. I mean, that sounds delicious.
So that's number four. Go pick out package number four over there.
Okay. So the miso that you've just scooped out of the package looks sort of almost chunky.
Yes.
And it's
genmai, which means it's whole
great.
Rice. Mm-hmm. And so it's got chunks of whole rice
and
that have been added to it.
Sort of brown rice. Dark, almost a chestnut color.
Yes.
And, it could be...
It's full-bodied. I would describe it as a very full-bodied miso.
Looks like Nutella.
On its own, it probably would... you would taste it and you would say it's very salty.
Uh-huh.
But as you're going to see, it's going to be transformed in the soup into something that's quite gorgeous. Dozo meshiangare, which means eat up. To which you say itadakimasu. And itadakimasu literally means I receive or I take from someone. And it indicates acknowledgement of the effort that went into making the food for you.
Itadakimasu. Well, that really is delicious. You've been in Japan a while, Elizabeth. May I say?
A while.
I mean, how long have you been here?
Almost 40 years.
Almost 40 years, and you're
obviously grown up when I got here.
it's a good thing we're
on radio, right?
No, but I mean to say, you're obviously fluent in Japanese. How did you develop this interest in gastronomy and cuisine?
It's a long, complicated story. Came to Japan in the 60s. Happened to land up in a household of people who ate well and simply, became intrigued with it. I began a formal course of study with a man who has unfortunately since passed away, who is my sensei. And
what
does
that mean, sensei?
Sensei is a teacher. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who had the vision that I could bring this body of knowledge to the non-Japanese speaking world.
Here in Now's resident foodie Scott Haas with Gourmet Magazine's Japan correspondent Elizabeth Ando. Here in Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A 7-year-old Louisiana boy is disciplined by his school for revealing that his mother is gay. The ACLU is preparing a suit. And our Washington Roundtable tackles the political issues of the day. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.